I call this meeting of House Military Veterans Affairs in order. It is 1:04 p.m. on Thursday, April 20th. We're in the Gruenberg Room, 120, at the State Capitol in Juneau. With me, I have Representative Shaw, Representative Gray, and Representative Sadler, and myself, Chair Wright. Let the record reflect, we have a quorum to conduct business. Please mute your cell phones. And first off, I'd like to thank Ms. Talia Ames, a veteran that I will always tout. Thank you for your service. She is from the Juneau LIO, and she's moderating our meeting today, and Mr. Justin Hayes, the House Records, for documenting our meeting today. We have two items on the agenda. First is an overview of the Air National Guard by Brigadier General Brian Cowell. And second, we have HB 155, Established Alaska Military Affairs Commission, by sponsor Representative Stapp. Brigadier General Cowell, please come forth and put your name on the record and start your presentation.
Afternoon. For the record, I am Brigadier General Brian Cowell, ATAG, Commander of the Alaska Air National Guard, a member of the Department of Military and Veterans Affairs for the state. So here to give you an overview of the Alaska Air National Guard. Before I start, I have a hype video I'd like to show you, cover most of the things I will cover in my briefing, but in a much better fashion. So we'll start with the video.
Whoever controls Alaska controls the world. They used to call it Seward's Folly. But buying Alaska from the Russians was the biggest mistake. But was it? We are the Alaska Air National Guard. For more than 70 years, our existence in Alaska is evidence that this state maintains its place as the most strategically located stronghold in the entire Northern Hemisphere. Our missions are designed to fully take advantage of this strategic location. From Alaska, you can reach anywhere in the Northern Hemisphere within 12 hours by airlift. With air refueling being one of our core missions, that distance is not only possible to cover, but we do it all the time. Thus, our ability to transport cargo and rescue forces is essentially infinite. We have aircraft and forces conducting missions 24/7, 365. We are always in the skies. In fact, we have C-17s in the air right now supporting the United States Transportation Command throughout the world. We defend and protect sovereign American airspace with constant vigilance over our skies. When foreign aircraft enter American airspace, they are immediately intercepted by our airmen. Rest assured that American and Alaskan airspace is kept safe. In addition to the visible skies, we detect, track, and target near-peer space threats by reducing the risk of unpredictable decaying orbits, therefore needing a blanket of freedom and safety over North America. Alaska is our home. We have partnered with the state of Alaska to be responders in search and rescue operations. Our team can save Alaskans when no one else can. We are agile innovators, working united and relentlessly to stay ahead. We lead by employing forces around the state and world to sustain engagements, enabling strategic reach to save lives, project power, and conduct global operations. We take pride in the fact that we have over 2,500 men and women trained and ready for combat, combat search and rescue, and combat mission support, ready to protect and defend Alaska and our nation. We are united by one commanding principle: love. Love for our fellow man, for our freedoms, for Alaska, our home, and for the United States of America. None of us are exactly the same, but we are all Alaskans, protecting and serving Alaskans.
For America and for you.
We are always ready, always there,
Always have been, always will be.
All right, who's ready to join? Yes, sir. I'm happy to take you.
Let the record reflect Representative Groh has joined us.
Under view. Full screen. Yeah. Okay. There we go. All right, so this afternoon I'll give you a quick overview of our key leaders, our organization assets, and then our 24/7 operations. To start with, the Air National Guard is under the commissioner of the DMVA, Adjutant General Torrance Sachs, and Deputy Commissioner Craig Christensen. On the state side. So our key leaders, I brought pictures so you can see how handsome and attractive we are. General Sachs looks a little interesting on the screen there. So Major General Torrance Sachs, like I said, the Adjutant General, his senior enlisted advisor is Command Sergeant Major Julie Small. I am the commander of the Alaska Air National Guard. My senior enlisted advisor is Command Chief Master Sergeant Kim Grove. Down at J-Bear, the 176th Wing Commander is Brigadier General Tony Stratton, and his senior enlisted advisor is Chief Master Sergeant Pete Pratt. And at Eielson, the 168th Wing Commander, Colonel Michael Griesbaum, and his senior enlisted advisor is Chief Master Sergeant Jeff Ling. So to start with the assets and personnel, I'll start north and work south. We have about 825 airmen in the 168th Wing, which is located on Eielson Air Force Base with a geographically separated unit at Clear Space Force Station, about 100 to 120 folks out at Clear. The 168th Wing is main mission is air refueling. Currently, we have 8 KC-135 tankers. Their mission is to fill up with gas and then aerial refuel other aircraft. We are currently working towards an active association where we'll gain 4 more KC-135s and about 230 active duty Air Force members to augment that mission. We're slated to start taking ownership of the aircraft at the end of this year. The secondary mission, or second mission, I guess not secondary, but is the space warning out of Clear. Their job is to to above atmospheric airspace, watch for ballistic missiles, and to track Earth orbiting objects. So they track everything that's orbiting the Earth and monitor its position relative. Moving south, we have the Department of Military Veterans Affairs and Joint Force Headquarters of the National Guard at J-Bear on the Fort Richardson side. So Joint Base Elmendorf Richardson. I'll try not to use acronyms, but it's part of my vocabulary. That's on the Fort Richardson side at the large green building over there. Then at the 176th Wing on the Elmendorf side of J-Bear, we have several mission sets. To start with, we have the Air Defense Squadron, which is watches Alaskan airspace for aircraft and ballistic missiles for protection of our sovereign space. We have the 144th Strategic Airlift Squadron. They have 8 C-17 aircraft that are capable of delivering personnel and equipment anywhere in the world, especially when it's tied to our KC-135s at Eielson. The refueling capability they can get anywhere in the world from J-Bear. And then lastly, we have the Rescue Triad at J-Bear. To start with, those are 3 rescue squadrons. The 212th Rescue Squadron is the pararescue men, combat rescue officers, and survival specialists that the other 2 aircraft deliver on scene to search and rescue survivors. We have 4 HC-130J Hercules, capable of airdrop, helicopter air refueling, and tactical airlift for search and rescue operations. And then I only show four helicopters, but we actually have six HH-60G Payhawks, which is the best part of the Alaska Air National Guard. That was my flew Payhawks. I also flew KC-135. So. All right. So next, as you notice, we're a fairly large Air National Guard. It's distinct from other states. The thing that I think makes us more distinct is we're not your traditional Air National Guard. And by traditional, I mean one weekend a month, 2 weeks a year. Our members are extremely busy, but about 70% of our members are working some sort of active mission all the time. We have 24/7 enduring missions that start with at Eielson. We have the Alaska NORAD region tanker alert, air refueling. So if detected an entry into our Alaska airspace, they launch and air refuel the jets that are intercepting those aircraft. The missile warning, the space warning squadron at clear 24/7. We have at least four members on console all the time. To go with that, we have the 268 security forces, which also defend that base. Down south, we have strategic airlift. So in the video, it said, you know, we have one C-17 airborne right now for the DOD, and that is a continuous mission. We always have at least one of the eight on the road. We could have up to four on the road at any one time. And then search and rescue. So we sit search and rescue for aviation and military SAR in the state of Alaska. And then we coordinate routinely with the Alaska State Troopers and the Coast Guard to conduct land search and rescue and water search and rescue when they need. And then lastly, Air Defense Squadron. Like I said, 24/7, there's a team of about 12 members on console all the time, watching the skies of Alaska for defense of our airspace. All right, so with that, I will open it up to questions, sir.
Are there any members on the committee, Representative Sandler?
Thank you, the Chair. General Kyle, good to see you here. Thank you for your presentation. If I weren't too old, I'd probably raise my right hand, too. Sir, I understand that the refueling mission is one of the enduring 247 missions. And I had some experience with the Representative J-Bear before. Are the KC-135s ever going to be upgraded to the KC-46 or to the KC-767? Or what's in the future for a refueling duty?
That's a big question. Okay, so through the chair, currently we are there's a MOB to transition KC-135s to KC-46s. Right now, Alaska and Hawaii are not on the list to receive them, but we're working through our national representatives to try to get to be part of the next transition from 135s to KC-46s. So we would like to see them upgraded. They are 1958 to 1962-ish aircraft. So, yes, we hope to have them upgraded, just not sure when. There's not a plan right now. So the question come up about our SAR mission. Right now, we work through the Rescue Coordination Center at J-Bear. They manage aviation and military SAR in the state, work with the FAA, and then they are our coordinating unit with the Alaska State Troopers that are responsible for land SAR, and then maritime SAR is the Coast Guard's, and we work well with District 17 down here through the Rescue Coordination Center. On average, since 1993, we average somewhere around 100 missions a year. It truly varies. Through the years, obviously, technology and capabilities have changed. So in the early years, we were much busier because of the lack of sat phones and tracking devices, and we worked off of raw radar data and launched on many missions that were now people are able to contact us on sat phones, those kind of things. So it has tailored down some, but we still average about 100 missions a year, and incidents in the 300s. An incident is something that doesn't go to full mission where we don't launch an aircraft. So that's just phone coordination. I don't have the specific stats for this year or last year with me, but it's roughly those numbers.
Any other questions from the committee? Representative Sandler?
Always. You don't know if I can get the general here to ask questions of Mr. Chair. Through the Chair, General Kyle, we often hear in this building about the challenges in getting workforce to the various jobs and careers and vocations that Alaska needs to have a vibrant economy. Federal DOD spending is an important part of the economy and of our districts. So I'll ask you your opinion of what the recruitment and retention perspective is for the Alaska Air National Guard, not just new recruits, but people who transfer in from other units around the country.
Yes, sir. So through the chair, we sit at about 90% fill rate in the Alaska Air National Guard. It's a little tougher, about 88% at ILSN, about 92% at JBAR. What we're seeing nationally, it affects us here in Alaska, is a much lower percentage of the population that are qualified to join military service. And then you look specifically in Alaska, of that, it's about 18% that are qualified. A large portion of them are interested in active duty service that takes them outside of the state and, to other missions. The Navy, for example, steals a lot of our young people. Steals. So we focus on some new recruits, high school into the Air National Guard, but the majority of where we gain our infrastructure of personnel is from active duty, those that come to Alaska, love Alaska, and stay here and join off of active duty. Roughly about 100 to 120 members a year come off active duty into the Alaska Air National Guard. And we're in the 20s with folks straight out of high school. So it's a large number come off active duty or come back to the state after serving a four-year stint in active duty.
I know that the video touched on it, but could you talk about the mission of the tankers that we recently acquired here in Alaska? Why the importance of it?
Yeah, extremely important mission at Eielson Air Force Base. So right now we have eight KC-135. I mentioned they're 1958 to 1962 models, so older than most of us here in this room. And it's amazing that they continue to fly. We are getting four more, which help, right? If you can't have new ones, you can have more, and it allows you to have a much larger use rate. The mission itself, we launch very rapidly to get the fighters out to aircraft entering our airspace without a flight plan, and we have to be able to respond at a moment's notice. So those members live and sleep in a bunker at the airfield and are ready to go on a moment's notice to get out. There are complications, right, at Eielson, 40 below, old aircraft. So it takes a lot to maintain them. It also takes a lot of maintainers to prep them for flight. We need to keep heaters on the jets. If it's not hangared, we have to keep them warm so they can launch. We're certainly looking for upgraded hangar space up there into the future and working on that as part of the association.
Representative Gray?
Thank you. To the chair, you touched on smaller amount of the population that's qualified to serve. Can you talk about what are the issues that are making people less qualified?
Through the chair. So I can hit on them. I'm not 100%, I'm not going to be perfect with numbers, those kind of things. But there are a lot of things from ASVAB scores to youth prescription, drug use as children that affect. And then injuries. We're very strict on, different injuries as people come in. We're adjusting tattoo policies, but that's also been an issue. Trying to think of the other. There's lots of health related issues that we struggle to allow people initial entry into the military. Things where once you're in, you can stay in, but joining is a difficult process.
Follow up.
Thank you. I'll ask one follow-up. There was an article in the Military Times about 10 days ago that talked about how electronic medical records are actually making that whole injury issue worse, because in the past, I do not speak for the Department of Defense.
Right.
Or for any organization, I'm speaking for myself. The article touches on the past, a recruiter could say that somebody was A-OK, but because of our electronic medical records, we're now not able to do that. Can you talk about that? Thank you.
Yes, sir, through the chair. So again, I'll be careful that I'm not speaking for the whole Department of Defense here. Certainly, the ability to track someone's medical records electronically versus paper and having a paper copy and all of that is gives us much more fidelity on someone's entry qualifications. I would agree that it probably limits people that in the past may not have been limited.
Representative Groom.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. General, I just want to get that name. You mentioned as a barrier to recruitment scores, and you used an acronym. Could you describe the acronym and explain what it means?
Yes, sir. Please. So through the chair, the ASVAB is Armed Services Entry Aptitude. I can't remember the whole thing, but I'm
Vocational.
It's bad. And battery? Aptitude battery. So they're acronyms. Sorry, I think we got there. But essentially what it does is it's a written test that measures vocational reading, writing, general mechanics, those types of things, and it is a standardized test that have minimum scores for entry, and each service has different requirements.
Follow up, Mr. Chair. General, is the problem the minimum scores got raised, or that the applicants are now showing lower scores? And if it's the latter, could you describe more in how this shows up, or in what particular categories this might be, the deficiencies or shortcomings are appearing?
So, through the chair, I don't know that I could speak completely intelligently on all of the barriers. I just know that it has become somewhat of a barrier. I think with the lower, I would say less people with the aptitude to join, less people taking the test, so there's a less of a population to draw from. So, there are, you can take the test multiple times. Just a lot of times the way that the test is given, I would say, probably is a barrier. A lot of times it's given in high school at lunchtime. There are lots of things that go with that test. So I don't know that I could speak intelligently on why the scores are lower. It certainly has been an issue for us. So,
let the committee remember that the general, he is a pilot. He is not a recruiter. He doesn't administer tests. So
we're all recruiters, sir. All recruiters.
Representative Sadler.
Thank you. Well, braving the chairman's ire, through the chair, General Kyle. You did mention, we all want to encourage young people to enlist. I think it's a great career or a great complement to a career. And one of the factors that you mentioned, a different factor in as an obstacle to some people's enlistment, is youth drug use. And to risk my chairman's ire, I'm going to ask you a question. Maybe a good question, maybe a bad question. There is legislation that would expunge the record of minor misdemeanor marijuana possessions. Would that tend to inhibit or to encourage enlistment? Or would, is that a factor you'd consider knowing that someone's record had been expunged? Or is there kind of a we-don't-want-to-know factor?
So through the chair, I would say it goes back to the question about electronic records. So if we know, then we have to act on the records. If the record was expunged, and then it would not be a disqualification at that time.
So we'll do that. Hold on.
Thank you.
Seeing no other questions, thank you, Brigadier General Kyle. I really do appreciate you coming out and presenting us. We know that the work you do is critical for the safety of Alaska, so please go back and do it. Please man the watch. We really do appreciate you. Thank you.
Thanks, sir.
Three buddies. Back on record. That brings us before us HB 155, established Alaska Military Affairs Commission. HB 155 is sponsored by Representative Stapp. He is joined with his staff, Ms. Honor Miller Austin. They will present the bill for the first time here today. Please come forth and put yourselves on the record.
Well, thanks, Chair Wright, and the wonderful members of the Military and Veterans Affairs Committee. For the record, my name is Representative Will Stapp, Representative East Fairbanks, and privileged to be joined by my illustrious staff today, Ms. Honor. Honor, will you go ahead and put yourself on the record?
Through the chair, my name is Honor Miller Austin, staff to Representative Will Stapp.
And thanks for the opportunity to present HB 55 or 155 today, excuse me. I know that we have some wonderful folks that are going to testify on her behalf regarding some of this stuff. And with the permission of the chair, I'd like to ask them to kind of give an overview if they have a slideshow for you wonderful folks. So,
absolutely. Please continue.
through the chair to Rep. Wright, I'm looking for Ms. Kluta and Mayor Ward from Fairbanks.
Mr. Nolan Kauda, are you on the line?
Mr. Chairman, yes, I am.
Awesome. So, Nolan, would you please start your...
Yes, Mr. Chairman. So I can... I take it somebody will advance my slides, Nolan, as I speak.
Did you wait one? Sorry.
I can share my screen as well, if that works.
Oh, no, it's fine. We're going to start with Mayor Bryce Ward.
Oh, excellent. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. Mayor Ward, how are you doing today?
Good. Good to hear from you. If you're ready, I can start.
Absolutely. Please, go ahead.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, my name is Bryce Ward. I'm the Fairbanks North Star Borough Mayor, and I'm going to talk a little bit about HB 55 and the Military Affairs Commission. I'm going to start off going over a few things. I don't have any fancy slides today, so you'll just be hearing from me over the phone here. But I'm going to talk about some of the common themes that you see across other states with military affairs offices. To start off with, states with active and aggressive military affairs offices often report gains in their state economies from focused attention on the defense industry. In many states, offices originate from a gradual process that typically responds, it's a response to BRAC. Many more have developed as an advocacy role for the state and for the state economy as it comes to the military industry. Officials who work directly for the governor cite the advantage of access and authority as part of the military affairs commissions. Other offices fill their missions through cabinet level positions across state offices. And there's a few that are out there that are independent. The bill that you have before you proposes this to be a state office run through the governor's office. The Military Affairs Office aims to protect and develop the defense industries more effectively. Common missions of offices, which I would propose that the State Office for Alaska take on, is facilitating communication between bases and activities of the surrounding community, providing a centralized resource for state officials, installation commanders, and business community members to reach out to troops and their families and the rest of the general public. They help the state prepare for the future of their installations, whether they have gained or lost personnel and or functions in previous backgrounds. And they also address mutual concerns such as encroachment and transportation and quality of life for military families. Boosting the defense industry by increasing defense expenditures, recruiting local businesses, and promoting the importance of the military to the state's well-being is another role that MACs generally provide. Military affairs commissions or committees work to ensure that the state and the congressional leadership of a local area are coordinated in their efforts to support the industry and the essence of state military affairs as an enterprise across the entire state. And I would point out that there has been a renewed focus on the Arctic and Alaska in particular, with development of Arctic strategies by every branch of the military, and that it is critical that the state be positioned to have a voice and to be able to engage with our military leadership, both in the state, but then also as we talk about our global presence and the need of that additional security in the Arctic. Currently, the Fairbanks North Star Bureau is engaged in military discussions across the nation, and the state is notably absent from many of those conversations. Fairbanks tends to carry the message for Alaska, but there's many aspects of military engagement across the state that we're just not able to speak to, most notably coastal issues or discussions with the Navy or the Marines. We're landlocked. We're pretty far away from the ocean in the Fairbanks area. A MAC has the ability to pull expertise from across the state of Alaska to really have comprehensive discussions on how we as a state can really position ourselves to support the military, to support military families, and the defense of our nation. I'd be happy to answer questions if you have any in regards to the Military Affairs Commission as proposed.
We do have a question from Representative Ray.
Thank you. Through the chair, Mayor Ward, thanks for being here today. My question is about whether you believe that this bill would help with the issues that you and I have discussed about housing and the increase in the number of service members that were sent to Eielson and some of the, I know people don't like to use the word crisis, but in terms of, you know, trying to take care of a big housing need. Do you think this would have helped with those negotiations?
Yes, thank you. Through the chair, I think as we look at quality of life and the issues that impact our military families, having a statewide coordinated effort would certainly help in that, whether it be coordinating resources for housing projects. I think a military affairs committee and commission at a statewide level could certainly help with that issue.
Thank you.
Let the record reflect Representative Rauscher joined us. Are there any other questions? Thank you, Mayor. We really appreciate your time and your presentation or your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Wright.
That brings us to you, Nolan. Are you there? Can you hear us?
Yes, I hear you, Mr. Chairman.
Will someone be able to man his slides? Perfect. So we do have someone in the room who will man your slides. Please. Go ahead.
Begin. Right. Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, I'm Nolan Clauda. I direct the University of Alaska Center for Economic Development. And what I want to talk to you about today, our center led an initiative between 2019 and 2021, taking a deep dive, looking into the military in Alaska and a lot of different aspects of it, including its economic impacts and the state of the defense sector in Alaska, the characterizing the businesses that make up the defense contracting base. We also included, when we say the defense contracting base, we're also talking about Coast Guard as well as Army and Air Force and Navy. But I can give an overview, and I'm going to talk a bit about some of those economic impacts and some of the recommendations that came out of the process that we had that lead to something very much like the proposed structure that we're talking about. here today. So on our next slide, we if you look at any of the big industries in Alaska, you know, the mining industry, the tourism industry, the seafood industry, oil and gas, they all have their industry associations and their groups that make and we're on the next slide actually, on slide three, and that offer these reports talking about how many jobs are created by that industry each year, and also that advocate on behalf of those industries and do really excellent work, you know, as far as helping strengthen our economy, because all of these major industries matter enormously to us. But on the next slide, you know, some of the impacts that you see from that, these are the jobs created by those industries during the time period 2019 and 2020, you know, oil and gas altogether, when you add up all the indirect and induced effects, you know, almost 80,000 jobs, mining 9,200, seafood 58,700. So where does the military play in this? And on the next slide, we did that analysis at the center. We showed that that all of the spending that results from the military presence in Alaska, this is spending on contractors, spending on payroll, all of the things that all of that money circulating creates about 58,000 jobs in the state, and about 33,000 of those being civilian jobs, because a lot of economic information, you know, talks about civilian employment. Most of our official employment numbers track that. So that's about 1 in 10 civilian jobs in the state and about 1 in 6 total jobs in the state. And so if you put that in perspective, you know, that's bigger than any industry other than oil and gas, if you look at it that way, because even though seafood sometimes has a few more jobs, it has more seasonal employment and lower total payroll that accounts for it. On the slide you're looking at now, this is the breakout of how the number of jobs come from. You have about 30,000 people that are directly under DOD or Coast Guard employment. Those include the active duty service members, but also reservists, members of the National Guard, and civilian employees as well, civilian federal employees of DOD or Coast Guard. And then you have the contractor employment, the 10,000 that you see there, the businesses that do direct work with the military, and then an additional tier of spending, another 18,000 jobs. And that's how you get to this almost 60,000 job figure, around 58,000 jobs in the state. And on the next slide, looking at the interior of Alaska, about a third of all the jobs in the interior are tied to military. That's a third of the civilian jobs. It's actually even a bit more than that if you account for the military positions directly. So that's a huge impact there. On the next slide, looking at the Anchorage and Mat-Su area together, about 1 in 10 jobs in the Anchorage and Mat-Su area as a combined unit are tied to the military. You know, around 17,000 civilian jobs, 30,000 total jobs. And I highlight those two areas, but there's actually military or Coast Guard spending in almost every borough or census area in the state of Alaska. When we looked at the study, we found that there were just a couple. There was maybe one borough or census area that didn't have any spending in it within about a 2 or 3 year period. So the military has a really enormous impact and doesn't necessarily have a lot of advocacy on its own behalf in a lot of ways, the way that other industries do. So on this next slide, slide nine, this is one aspect of our work. We had a consultancy that we hired to look at this issue, interview stakeholders in Alaska, and look at best practices around the country, review a lot of research. And they came away with this dual recommendation for establishing a statewide military coalition or alliance through state legislation, and going hand in hand with that of creating an office of military affairs within state government. So these two recommendations, and I think the bill that we're talking about is really addressing that first one. And on the next slide, a little bit about what that body might be. Like these are the generalized ideas about it. I know that some of these ideas have already been put into draft legislation. But the members of the body being appointed by statutes, members representing military communities, representing the private sector, meet regularly to discuss and act on key issues, and should build continuity between administrations, especially between gubernatorial administrations, not just an effort that spins up in one administration and then fades. The next one talks a little bit more about some of the purpose and mission and activities, what this unit would do. And this is in line, by the way, with other units around the country that do this. And Mayor Ward mentioned some of these, advocating to Congress and DOD in support of Alaska's military installations, missions in the defense sector. Worth noting that communities all over the country and states all over the country compete very actively and aggressively to strengthen their military presence. You know, when there's a possibility of a mission being located somewhere, states try their hardest to attract that mission. And often those efforts are done at the community level, but they often need the horsepower of a state level type of effort. So the unit would advise the governor and the legislature on defense and military issues, develop strategies to protect the state's existing military missions, but also positioning Alaska to compete for new and expanded missions, identifying the public infrastructure needs and making recommendations to state for grant assistance programs to support retention and expansion of military installations. So you think about some of the issues I think Representative Gray mentioned around housing. I think a body like this would be pretty important in channeling some of that discussion around the needs for an installation or an expanded mission. Next slide, some continuation of some of those missions and activities, reviewing state policies to support military installations and maximize economic benefits to local communities, making recommendations to improve the quality of life of uniformed service members, veterans, and their families. And that's a very important issue that the military looks at with basing decisions, is what's the surrounding quality of life for the personnel that are going to be based there, because the military's dealing with the same kinds of workforce retention issues that other employers are, and they want their people to be happy and satisfied where they're based. And sometimes Alaska can be a tough place to be stationed, for all kinds of reasons. So those are some of the aspects, expanding connections and collaboration. One other aspect of this before my last slide that I'll mention is that one of the recommendations was that a unit like this shouldn't be housed within the equivalent of a Department of Military and Veterans Affairs, that it would make the most sense to be within either a governor's office or a Department of Commerce. And the reason for that being that this is to a large degree an economic development related effort, maintaining that healthy defense sector in the state and potentially looking at ways to expand it. So the last few considerations, and Mayor Ward mentioned these things too, the Department of Defense and Coast Guard, Arctic strategies that are in place, and the DOD Arctic strategy, I think, is in the process of being updated right now. That has a lot of implications for Alaska, but there's a lot of work on our side to be done, I think, as a state to actually attract some of those missions, to get, icebreakers, potentially down the road, maybe home ported in Alaska, which would have a lot of dollars that follow it. The Arctic deep draft port, that's going to be built out in Nome. What kind of a presence for a Coast Guard or DOD goes along with that? And what do we have to do to make that happen or to help that happen? And increasing the overall attractiveness for basing decisions that affect all of these things. I think there's a pretty critical timing to doing something like this. So I would be happy to take any questions from the committee.
Sorry. Thank you. We do have a question from Representative Gray.
Thank you, Mr. Cotter, for being here. My question is, if we go to slide 10, when we were talking about the considerations for putting together the committee, the coalition, the alliance, whatever we're doing, I'm wondering if there might be room for geographic representation. And two considerations there. Mayor Ward had brought up that, Fairbanks, when Fairbanks is kind of the leader, they may not be as in tune with coastal issues. And I will say the second consideration is that, again, I don't speak for the Guard in any way, but I would say that the Army Guard tends to be pretty centered at Fort Richardson. And sometimes that even just not having more representation in the Fairbanks area can cause some issues. So I didn't know, it looks like the sponsor has kind of implied to me with his eyes that we might be touching on geographic representation, but I just wondered if there was any consideration there about geographic representation when discussing this potential board.
Through the chair, Representative Gray, I'll say as a generic matter that I think that geographic representation on this would be very important, and I think that was meant to be implied by the members representing military communities and associated constituencies, including and certainly including coastal communities that are that are really dependent on that Coast Guard presence. But I think if Representative Stapp may be able to speak more to the language of the bill.
Representative Stapp, would you like to get into your presentation before we get you going on questions?
Yeah, through the chair to Representative Wright and members of the committee, yeah, I'd be happy to take the reins here, and that's the will of the body here. So. Absolutely. Well,
thank you, Nolan.
Yeah. Thanks, folks. So again, for the record, my name is Representative Will Stapp. I represent actually Fort Wayne, right? So thanks for the shout out there, Representative Gray. You know, oftentimes, folks, you and I are told that we need to choose between a right and a left. I would propose that regarding this bill, there's really only an up or a down. So my argument behind the nucleus of this military state affairs commission, and then I'll hand off to my staff for some of the details regarding things that have been done in the past regarding ACAS, is Alaska stands at the precipice of kind of a new geopolitical reality, not only in the country, but worldwide. We might have been considered the last frontier for most of our existence, but as it turns out, the last frontier is actually the front line of defense in America's new changing landscape, especially as new threats emerge from Asia. So the purpose behind the commission is to effectively be able to capitalize on all the DOD investment that is coming to our towns. I represent Fairbanks, but it's not just Fairbanks, it's Anchorage. Down at Clear, we have a Space Force installation. In Kodiak, we have a Coast Guard installation. There's talk of even the Marine Corps getting a foothold in the great state of Alaska. So my argument behind the nucleus of HB 155, if you've heard from my mayor in Fairbanks and Nolan from the UA system, is that we have to be able to have the right tools and the right people in place in the right positions to be able to effectively capitalize on what will be great opportunities, not just for our local community in Fairbanks, folks in Anchorage and the Mathsu and Southeast and Western Alaska, but we want to ensure that we are taking a role. When I was in the infantry, we used to talk about leading from the front and being able to make sure that we have the largest seat at the table throughout the process. So as far as some of the details of the bill, and maybe I'll talk about the previous commission, I'm going to hand it over to my illustrious staff, Ms. Honor.
Thank you. And for the record, my name is Honor Miller-Austin, Representative Will Stapp's staff. And I would like to talk a little bit about the sectional, just kind of in brief. So Section 1 of the bill establishes the commission in staggered three-year terms for members after the committee is established, after the terms discussed in Section 3, or initially the terms in Section 3. So what I'm trying to say is, in Section 1, it establishes a commission and sets staggered three-year terms for the members after the initial first year. And then that term is discussed in Section 3. And in Section 2, it just discusses the sunset of the commission, which is June 30th of 2030. And also, a lot of questions have been brought up about the Alaska Civilian Armed Services Team, also known as ACAS, and that has sunset. Their last meeting was April 10th. So we have, like a lot of people have said, why is this needed? And what's the difference? And so I would like to reflect back on ACAS was kind of a loosely organized committee, whereas our bill is trying to give structure and operate through the governor's office, dealing with federal relationships directly and trying to unify Alaska as a whole.
Questions, Chair Wright?
Thank you. Are there any questions from the committee? Representative Sadler.
Thank you, to the chair. Miss Honor, Mr. Bill. ACAS, could you repeat the acronym, please? What does ACAS stand for?
Yeah, of course. Through the chair, ACAS is Alaska Civilian Armed Services Team.
I'm sorry, through the chair, could you kind of amplify under whose auspices was it organized? What did it do? Where was it based?
Yeah, it was an administrative order 291 from 2017 under Governor Walker.
Thank you. Well, if I may follow up. The question I'd ask you, the chair, to the sponsor, I guess, is where would the proposed Alaska Military Affairs Commission slot in alongside the Military and Veterans Affairs Committee, the Joint Armed Services Committee, the Department of Military and Veterans Affairs, Fairbanks's existing Tiger Team, and the Anchorage Chamber of Commerce Military Affairs Committee. What space would it occupy that these...
Yeah, through the chair to Representative Sandler, you actually kind of hit the nail on the head. The entire purpose behind this is to unify all of those different types of aspects. And so it's effectively modeled after the structure that we use in Fairbanks for the Tiger Team, and to make that concept be a statewide entity in which we can be a one team, one fight, as the chair likes to say, a unified approach, and give an organization the proper structure to be able to really facilitate a lot of different moving pieces when it comes to industrial development, economic development, and, of course, interpersonal relationships with our thing. So I was privileged enough to be able to serve in both active duty brigades in the state, the old Stryker Brigade on Fort Wainwright, and, of course, the Airborne Brigade, and the member from Anchorage's district. And one of the best things about the concept behind this commission is the fact that we can not only harness the economic and industrial potential of the continued DoD investment, but we can ensure that Alaska, which I think was one of the greatest places for a soldier to come to the state and be able to participate in the domestic economy afterward, can not only be pipelined in active duty service, but have a pathway to be able to transition ultimately into civilian life and perhaps run for elected office someday. So,
and follow up? Through the chair, or to the sponsor, does the Department of Defense have any model that they have gotten behind or support or encourage in trying to encourage cooperation between the armed services, civilian authorities, legislative branches, executive agencies, et cetera?
Yeah, through the chair to Representative Sadler. So I can't really speak to the machinations of the Federal Department of Defense. I can say, however, that this commission is not unique to the state of Alaska. Actually, we're kind of behind the curve, and I'll cede that over to my illustrious staff member here to kind of articulate that a little bit better for you folks.
Well, before the staff starts, Ms. Miller-Austin, I'd like to say something. I've worked across lines, state lines, with a lot of folks, and this is something that is really important and critical in a lot of other states. I've seen the path. I've seen how it has affected. And the states have come into taking advantage of the industry. We don't do that often here in Alaska. So, you know, I applaud the bill sponsor for putting this bill together. This is something I wanted to see for the last 3 years, but you beat me to it. So thank you.
Through the chair, again, this is an honor for the record. I believe that there are states such as Texas and Colorado, as well as I'm sure there's multiple more. I have yet to do the extensive research on that. But they do have the established commission in their states already.
Yeah, and through the chair to the members of the committee, you'll find that most states with large military installations have some sort of system set up. And keep in mind, Alaska per capita has some of the largest military presence of any other state in the country, especially with a small population state. So,
Representative Gray?
Thank you. Through the chair, I'll just ask Representative Stapp. First of all, I strongly support this bill. Strongly support this bill. But I'm wondering if I asked Mayor Ward about Eielson and about some of the, I guess, trials with bringing a lot of new service members there. And if you could envision how this commission may have helped if we had done this a few years ago.
Oh, absolutely. Through the chair to Representative Grace, I'll give you a personal example. We hadn't been sworn yet, the representative and I, but we had discussed this issue. So Fairbanks had identified housing regarding Eielson and the F-35s and the KC-130s and things like that as part of our target team for a while. And we've been working on that issue domestically in the interior for a while. However, it didn't have a lot of statewide recognition because, you know, different geographical parts of the state are not always well known. You know, I confess myself, I'm ignorant on Coast Guard issues in Southeast, and I'm sure there are wonderful members in Southeast who are incredibly knowledgeable about that. But when a commission like this is in place, those types of regional disparities are going to be addressed and dealt with at a statewide level and hopefully, you know, actually fixed before they actually become an issue. So I'd like to envision a positive future for the state of Alaska that members like the member from Anchorage can envision potential challenges before they actually happen and have a system in place that you can mitigate and actually kind of alleviate those things. So we can make sure that we never have a military installation in this country that becomes a duty station that is unaccompanied, right? And for those of you who don't know what an unaccompanied duty station, that is an absolute travesty that for a period of time, Eielson Air Force Base was designated as an unaccompanied destination. So,
Representative Groh?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm Jim Stapp. I also support this bill, and I want to commend you for bringing it forward. I wanted to ask a couple of technical questions about it. And I've never, you know, served as a legislator to create a commission. So, I've interpreted these statutes or seen them, but I have never, had a part in creating them. One is there's, on page two of section one proposed statute, 44-19-857 terms. Says that members appointed under these statutes serve staggered terms of 3 years until reappointed or replaced and may be reappointed. When I think of staggered terms, I usually think that they have to start out at different lengths to end up staggered. So that would be my first question. Have you thought about it or talked with the drafters about how that would work?
Yeah, through the chair to Representative Groh, I think I'm going to defer to my well-read staff as far as talking about the staggered terms. My understanding is that they would all start at the same time, and they would have to be reappointed effectively when their staggered thing is over. But, Honor, would you go ahead and speak to that?
Stab at that? All right, I worked on boards and commissions, so I'll just take a stab at it if you don't mind. So they all will be appointed, and some will have maybe a 2-year, and some will have 3 years. And then they will go forth from there after their 2 years. The next folks will be 3 years, so it'll be staggered for continuity, so folks won't lose all that knowledge and information.
Mr. Chairman, to respond to you, I guess that would mean essentially that that the appointments by themselves, the person who appointed, would select the terms at the beginning or the length of the terms.
Well, there's individual seats, and the seat that they would come into would be the seat 2 year. Oh, I'm sorry. I will pass it on to. I'm getting into more details.
Through the chair, on page 3, line 30, so
okay, I think there you go.
Yeah, it says
reading.
Yeah, act shall be initially filled as follows.
Second issue that I have is the question of it also provides the commission shall meet quarterly at other times determined by the chair. Do you have a thought of whether that's adequate, whether it should set out more in terms of the work that it should do?
Through the chair, I think that as I was reading through this bill and how we have chosen the members for the committee, that they meeting quarterly is adequate for them to just get together and kind of discuss what's happening within the state. And then they can come together as they see fit more times throughout the year due to if there are bigger issues that need to be dealt with in that time frame. But quarterly seems to be a pretty adequate number.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
So there's no limit on meetings? They can have as many as they need to get the job done?
Through the chair, correct.
Perfect. Representative Gray?
Thank you. Through the chair, just to follow up on the topic of members of the commission, we in judiciary, we were talking with someone who'd been on their board for 23 years. Just curious, these folks can serve potentially forever?
Through the chair to Representative Gray, I believe that it's so yes and no. I believe that there is the like So they are chosen by the governor and then can be reappointed as many times as re-elected, I suppose.
So there's a term, serve at the pleasure of. So.
Thank you. So to the chair, potentially they could serve forever if the new governors kept reappointing them. Thanks.
Sorry. I suppose, yes. It is just determining, sorry, through the chair. It is, I suppose I should not be the one to answer this question. I will refer to my lifelines.
I'll be the lifeline through the chair to Representative Gray. Yeah, effectively, you know, in theory, if the governor loved somebody so much, he could reappoint them. Governors could reappoint them in perpetuity. That's not necessarily a bad thing. I mean, if you're doing an excellent job, bringing a lot of DOD investment and working with folks, you know, I think it's good. I would have a hard time believing that every governor from now until the end of my earthly life would appoint me to the commission, but I try to get along with a lot of folks, so maybe that'll be the case one day, you know. So,
okay. Representative Shaw?
I would make the assumption it's a lot like being a legislator. You could be elected forever as long as you make the people that you're working for happy.
Thank you, Representative Shaw. Any other questions from the committee? Seeing none, we will put a deadline for amendments on Wednesday at noon of next week. And that concludes the business we have for today on the agenda. Our next meeting will be Tuesday, April 25th. If there's no other business, we will adjourn at 2:07.